Off the Bench is a podcast
created by ASCLS
that will discuss the scientific
and not so scientific
ideas in laboratory medicine.
We are joined by members
of ASCLS, fellow scientists,
educators, and researchers,
along with those interested in the profession.
We share ideas
and talk nerdy.
This episode of Off the Bench is sponsored by the University of Cincinnati Online. Are you ready to take the next step in your medical laboratory career? Earn a Master of Science in Medical Laboratory Science Leadership from the University of Cincinnati Online and learn what you need to advance while still working in the field. Visit online.uc.edu/MSMLS to learn more.
Hello and welcome everyone to our April episode of the Off the Bench podcast. My name is Galina. I'll be your host today. And if you are a laboratorian working in a hospital, your location more than likely offers drugs of abuse testing. Your panel will include the usual suspects, you know, your amphetamines, cannabinoids, opiates, cocaine, benzodiazepines. Labs are also starting to adapt to the most recent fentanyl epidemic and offer that as part of their standard panels. What you don't see in the standard drugs of abuse panel is MDMA, ketamine, psilocybin, or DMT. And to talk to us about the reasons why, my guest today is Dr. Frederick Strathman, Senior VP for U.S. Business at Mobile Ion Systems. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So as a senior VP at Mobile Ion Systems, can you tell us a little bit more about what this company does?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a departure from sort of the topic that we'll talk about. But, you know, Mobile Ion Systems is a life sciences company. You know, we're positioned in sort of the hardware space. And so we make a technology that I think really has a lot of applications to what we'll talk about today. And it's called high resolution ion mobility. So it's very much in the mass spectrometry field. It's a separation science, has a lot of potential major impacts for clinical testing, and was really widely featured, not only our technology, but lots of other vendor technologies at the most recent conference out in California, MSACL. So it's definitely an emerging technology, something that I think is going to have a real tremendous impact for clinical testing, and drugs of abuse is something that I think is on the to-do list for sure in regards to the application of ion mobility.
Are these systems currently utilized in any clinical capacity, or where are you at in that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so we are, we are particularly a six-year-old company. And so our technology in particular has been on the market for about a year and a half. So there are some clinical laboratories that are looking at it, research, applied markets. And so we're really kind of across the board and also in the biopharma area as well. Now, our technology in particular connects to Agilent QTOFs. And so if you sort of know anything about clinical mass spectrometry, QTOFs are certainly not as common as triple quads. And so for that reason, you know, we have a very specific niche of where we actually fit quite well into the clinical lab. And we expect that to continue to grow for sure. But there are multiple different types of ion mobility that are out there that's been commercialized really over the last probably 5 to 10 years and has really started to increase in its interest for its ability to analyze things like lipids and glycans. PFAS is another opportunity that's really growing quickly. And so really it fits well anytime complex separations are something that people are thinking about. And our technology in particular is really well positioned because it has the capability to help to reduce some of that reliance on liquid chromatography, which is oftentimes a very complicated part of doing clinical mass spectrometry. So certainly, you know, it's moving into the clinical field. And as I mentioned at MSACL this year, there was an entire workshop on it. There was a symposium on it. There were quite a few plenary speakers. So it's a fast emerging topic. And so like what we're going to talk about today with psychedelics, it's another one of those sort of waves that's coming at the clinical lab for sure.
That's fantastic. And it sounds like it's has applications not only in the clinical field, but could be utilized in forensics, research, et cetera.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we probably won't have time to go into the details of it for sure, but there's some really interesting aspects to ion mobility that for me and my background as a high complexity CLIA lab director, and I've worked at reference labs. I've worked in hospital settings. For me, there's some really interesting implications. And, you know, the fact that you say forensics, it's an area that I was assistant lab director, as well as involved in operations and R&D at a reference lab that really focused on forensic and clinical toxicology. And there's really interesting aspects to improving the confidence in results, but also sort of giving us a way to do more predictive understanding of what compounds are emerging and what those drugs may in fact look like and be similar to in regards to overall structure. So there's some really interesting aspects in regard to where I think ion mobility is definitely going to find a home on both the clinical and the forensic side, like it has in research and is starting to move into areas like biopharma, drug discovery. So it's a really powerful technology. I'm extremely happy to see the clinical lab not too far behind, starting to adopt it, starting to bring this in. So it's going to be a really exciting next couple of years for ion mobility for sure.
That's fantastic. And really, the reason it was pertinent to invite you to speak on this topic from a clinical perspective is because up until recently, clinical labs performing this testing from the perspective of an abuse for, you know, employment testing, overdose cases, et cetera. However, there's been a fairly recent shift to using psychedelics and dissociative drugs to treat depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other life-affirming treatments. And outside of therapy, we're seeing more states push for legalization, decriminalization, et cetera. You know, I think just this year alone, Oregon was the first state to allow adult use for psilocybin. So we're seeing these compounds appear more and more outside of the abuse setting. And that begs the question of how do we start testing for these in a therapeutic setting? Do we need to test for it? And so the point of our discussion has little to do with politics, morals, et cetera, but the acknowledgement that as laboratories, we have some catching up to do with these trends. And again, we don't see testing of these substances in a standard drugs of abuse panel. And you know, one could argue that if used as a method of therapy, adding these tests to a quote unquote drugs of abuse panel, it kind of adds a potentially inappropriate stigma to those seeking mental health therapy in a legal controlled setting.
So yeah, it's really good points. So now we shift to talking about sort of the psychedelic compound, you know, and compounds. What's really interesting is, so that brings in my background of, you know, being a clinical toxicologist, as well as having experience in forensic toxicology. And exactly what you said was, you know, these compounds, so, you know, the ones that we actually spoke about last year at the annual scientific meeting for AACC, you know, these were sort of the four kind of most common ones that are sort of being talked about and sort of seen in the literature as sort of, you know, having a lot of value as therapeutics for various different types of psychiatric disorders, as well as other situations as well. One of those, MDMA, is actually in probably almost everybody's drug of abuse panel already. And so it's a bit more common, a bit more mainstream, but most people probably know it by the term ecstasy, which is obviously not what it would be called if you were giving it as a therapeutic. And so, you know, there is this really interesting stigma. And I think you did a nice job of framing that up, because what's really different about the psychedelics field and seeing this kind of move into mainstream is most therapeutic drugs don't start with this kind of concept of being drugs of abuse, right? They start as being therapeutic drugs right from the start. And so I think that really shows some unique aspects to this field, in the sense that anytime you talk about these compounds, the first thing everybody's going to think about is, oh, those are drugs that people abuse. Those aren't therapeutic drugs. And the abuse potential still remains high. And that's part of what we talked about in the at the annual scientific meeting in our symposia. And then we had a really nice Q&A article that came out in ClinChem from AACC as well, that dug into the details a little bit more with a couple of different experts in the field across various different areas. And so it's really interesting to see this body of knowledge emerge. But underneath of that is decades of research showing the power of these compounds that is very intertwined with this, the aspect that these are abuse drugs. And to your point, a lot of laboratories are not testing for ketamine or psilocybin or DMT. MDMA they're testing for, but certainly not from the standpoint of a therapeutic compound, it's abuse potential as well. And so it is going to be very interesting to see how the laboratory is prepared or needs to prepare as these compounds start moving through, you know, if they go through FDA approval and if they start making it into the mainstream, You know, it's definitely on the radar of a lot of toxicologists, and I think it's going to become even more important from the vendor perspective, as well as sort of the laboratory perspective as well, to be prepared for what do we need to do in order to get ready to test these compounds, not only as drugs of abuse, but also as potential therapeutics that are on the market.
Mm-hmm. And how we modify our test menu, what do we call it? How do we adapt to kind of remove the negative stigma around that?
Right. So I think it's a really good point in terms of removing that stigma. And I think that starts with, you know, one of the things we did talk in our symposia about was the fact that right now, if a physician called the laboratory, almost anybody's laboratory, and said, you know, I have a patient that's being provided MDMA as part of therapy, do you have a test that I could use to baseline them, or I could use to test them ahead of time for use, you would most likely point them to a drug of abuse panel. And it's not surprising that a physician and certainly a patient would not necessarily want to see a test result that says drugs of abuse when they're actually sort of providing therapeutic care. And so I think even something as subtle and simple as how these are named is something that the laboratory can be focusing on now to make sure that that stigma does not follow these compounds, you know, as they're starting to get more mainstream acceptance.
Right. Aside from the naming convention and how we're going to adapt to that, what I really wanted to focus on today is the mechanism of action, the therapy, drug pattern analysis of some of these substances being considered for therapeutic use, and what challenges and limitations laboratories are facing when looking at managing dosage for therapy, because eventually I could see that being a need of, hey, we need to figure out what the therapeutic dose for a patient is. And so what I wanted to start with, I think kind of four main ones. Let's start with MDMA, since you've already mentioned, you know, we already have it in our drugs of abuse testing. You know, what is the mechanism of action, therapy, and drug pattern analysis, or any interferences or issues that we uncover there?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we'll start with MDMA. And so this is a synthetic drug. It's known to alter mood and perception. Probably of all the ones that we're going to talk about is most likely the one that is the most well known and is not maybe as uncommon to most clinical toxicologists for sure. But it's very chemically similar to both stimulants and hallucinogens. And so for that reason, you know, its typical name is oftentimes ecstasy is one of the ways in which it's referred to. And that often comes with sort of feelings of increased energy, increased pleasure, emotional warmth, distorted sensory and time perception. And so you can see how it kind of falls into that category of being somewhat like a stimulant, but also a hallucinogen as well. And for that reason, it acts on everything that will, you know, be kind of similar to all of the other compounds we'll talk about with dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. So having those kinds of impacts, which is where you see some of that potential addictive behavior, but also sort of those positive feelings that come with some of these. That increase heart rate and blood pressure through norepinephrine, and then the serotonin, where you start to really see sort of this mood alteration, sleep, other functions that are really kind of associated with that. And then I think what gets really tricky for the laboratory then is, you know, seeing how these are going to be used. And I think you bring up a good point of, will we actually see the need for therapeutic monitoring of MDMA? And I don't know that that's necessarily the case right now. You know, there's lots of reasons as to why the lab develops tests and why physicians or clinical trials will utilize testing. So it's entirely possible that, you know, MDMA continues to be looked at as a standpoint of baseline therapy. And so, you know, one of the things that we had at our symposia last year at ASMS is we had a clinical psychologist who runs these clinical trials and provides these compounds as part of her therapy. And what was really strongly communicated that I don't think I really appreciated as much prior to this was, you know, this is not a, you know, take a prescription, go home, and you're just going to microdose on your own. This is a controlled environment. This is something that there needs to be a psychologist there, because if you don't do this correctly, just like a lot of things, there can be sort of, you know, unintended consequences. And so I think for that reason, you know, we're going to start seeing an evolution of, you know, what do we need to monitor, and baseline therapy for sure. You know, is somebody already doing something on their own? Are they not? And so a little bit of, you know, kind of that, let's get a baseline assessment of what drugs and what compounds you might actually have. But then even in something like MDMA, you know, so we know a lot about MDMA in terms of abuse potential. We know a lot about the metabolism profile and what shows up in urine and what shows up in blood and at what time. But I think what we don't tend to always know is what are those therapeutic concentrations that we would expect to see? And again, what the value is of those, and is that something actually need to measure? And then we kind of started the conversation on talking a little bit about ion mobility and some other sort of emerging technologies. And I think this is one of the reasons why for drug testing, whether it be therapeutic or abuse potential, you know, there are, you know, challenges with epimers, you know, so S and R, we talk about DNL and amphetamine, and those are pretty well known of needing to separate those. And so as we see something like MDMA that is both sort of on the street and illegal, but also potentially, you know, being prescribed and being utilized, there may be the same need to be able to differentiate these two, especially if we think about somebody who's being treated in a controlled environment, but maybe they're not responding the way that the physician would expect. Maybe their therapy is not going the direction they would hope it to go. You know, there may be questions of, well, there are other things in the system that are potentially interfering with this. You know, are they getting access to other forms of MDMA because they think, well, if a little bit helps, maybe a lot will really help. And so, you know, we have to be sort of very mindful of the fact that we are potentially going to see patients being treated with drugs that are out there already that potentially have that abuse potential. And so, you know, ion mobility is one of those technologies that has the capability to more easily separate these, more easily resolve these compounds, and make it a little bit simpler and faster for the clinical laboratory to let a physician know, this is consistent with what you're doing, or this is inconsistent with what you're doing, because we're not seeing the analytical profile that's consistent with therapeutic use of this, as opposed to, you know, potential drug abuse for sure.
What you mean by that is our current drug of abuse panel doesn't differentiate between S versus RMDMA. And so you don't have a way of knowing.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, up until, you know, it's a therapeutic drug, having MDMA in your system, that's the answer you need. Doesn't matter if it's R, doesn't matter if it's S, it doesn't matter anything like that, because you're not supposed to have MDMA in your system. So full stop, no reason to do any further testing. But it's very similar to sort of what has already played out for quite some time for amphetamine, is there are legal forms of amphetamine, there are illegal forms of amphetamine. And so that's where this DNL ratio test, not widely done and not sort of, you know, widely available, but it's more of a niche lab test that's actually done in, you know, sort of smaller reference laboratories, but ultimately it has a lot of value when, you know, a patient is not readily copying to the fact that they're taking an illegal source. So now we actually do have some testing capabilities, but as these compounds become more and more mainstream, it's going to be harder and harder to do a test in my clinical lab and then have to wait for 7 days for a, you know, DNL amphetamine or an RNS MDMA test to come back. A physician's going to want to resolve a bit quicker than that. So I think that represents definitely one potential analytical challenge for laboratories, is being able to keep up with what does my test need to provide in regards to information. And that's going to be, in a lot of ways, connected to, well, what do we already know about something like MDMA? And that's where in the symposia that we gave at AACC, we talked about what else is MDMA typically positive with when it comes to postmortem samples, when it comes to urine pain management samples, when it comes to seized drug materials. And so this is where I think this really elegant network of drug testing is out there, where we have laboratories that are doing seized material and drug chemistry work in the forensic side. And sometimes they don't oftentimes communicate to clinical laboratories, but ultimately what they're seizing and what they're pulling off of the streets is what may end up in individuals who are abusing drugs and show up for emergency room, or potentially as, you know, individuals that are part of this therapy. And then unfortunately, the farther side down of that is the postmortem results that we ultimately see, you know, when individuals have ultimately taken it too far and they now have, you know, potentially drug associated deaths or other unrelated reasons for that. And so it's really helpful, I think, to have that kind of understanding of what does an MDMA profile look like from an individual that's having this provided to them for therapy, versus what else might MDMA be associated with when it's not part of therapy. And so one of the things that we actually talked about with MDMA in particular is that when you look at seized drug material, you can sometimes find MDMA and methamphetamine together. Well, those are not related by metabolism. Those are not related by sort of impurities. So what that kind of tells you is that if you had a patient that was being prescribed or being treated with MDMA, their therapy maybe wasn't going the way that you would expect. Well, now if you actually do a larger test in the laboratory, you find MDMA and methamphetamine, well, that would be a bit of a red flag that you could report back to the physician and say, well, this is not a pattern that we actually see with therapeutic use of MDMA, but it is in fact a pattern that we may in fact see with MDMA that is sort of off of the street or is sort of the illegal form of this.
It's interesting because when I think of cross-reactivity, I don't typically think of that as a good thing, right? But in this case, it sounds like it could be a differentiating factor, like you were just mentioning.
Yeah, and it really goes to, you know, one of the things that I think is really an interesting aspect too of the laboratory is, you know, most all clinical toxicology follows what is very classically seen as a forensic workflow where there's typically a screen of some kind that's maybe not as specific that has that broad cross-reactivity, but ultimately you get an answer that's not typically actionable from a clinical standpoint, right? So if you have a patient that presents and you take a urine sample and you run it to your laboratory and you have, for instance, an immunoassay screen, well, you may come back with a result that says amphetamines, right? But that could be amphetamine, it could be methamphetamine, it could be MDMA, it could be something that is not even related to amphetamine because of cross-reactivity. But that's kind of been the workflow that we've really had in clinical toxicology. And if you mirror that with forensic toxicology, there it's very important to have screen with reflex workflows because you want to be able to find it twice by two different methods. And that's based on the regulations on the forensic side, but also really on the idea of, you know, what are you actually going to do with this result? And when it's for forensic purposes, where there's going to be legal action taken, you know, oftentimes you want to make sure that it's not a false positive or an analytical error in some way. But I think in the clinical side, what has become very interesting is that historically, screen with reflex has always worked really well because if you look at things like workplace drug testing or even forensic testing, it's mostly a lot of negatives, right? So most of the time, you don't know what the patient's taking. You don't even know if they are taking anything. And so a broad, cheap, fast screen made a lot of sense. But when pain management really emerged as a growing area of clinical toxicology, now all of a sudden the positivity rates went from 4 and 5% to over 70%. So what that meant was we were generating a lot more screen positives that were not very clinically actionable because there's false positives, there's potential for false negatives, there's all that cross-reactivity. And so we started to see the emergence of directed analysis testing where now that I have a patient who I know is supposed to be taking these three drugs, well, what if I just do a specific test for just those three drugs instead of doing that arguably somewhat wasted step of doing the screen? Because I know what they're taking, I know what they should be taking, but to your point, you lose a little bit of that cross-reactivity that comes with immunoassays. And so what we really need to be able to have is a blend of the two, which is how do we do a targeted analysis, but maintain that capability of doing that untargeted in the background. So that way we can say, I'm really interested in these three drugs because two of these are prescribed and one of these has, you know, maybe a history of abuse. But at the same time, well, I want to see other things that potentially could be there as well. And so that's where I think mass spectrometry has positioned itself well in the toxicology field. It's not fully mainstream because it's still complex, takes a lot of expertise, but a lot of companies are working on how do we actually lower that technology barrier. But ultimately, it really sort of sets the stage well for, you know, I want to be able to get specific results. I want to be able to keep them as broad as possible, but I also want to make them very specific. And so I think that's where the lab has done a good job in general to be able to get ready to receive the need to do this kind of testing by ideally these more directed analyses. So we don't lose what you're saying with that cross-reactivity being a good thing, but it's not cross-reactivity in the sense of, well, I know something's there, but I don't know what it is, but we know exactly what's there. And then I think that really helps to, you know, get to the point of these signatures that you might see with MDMA only, MDMA and methamphetamine, amphetamine as a metabolite of methamphetamine, that really complex clinical picture can be unraveled and then really timely and useful results can be provided to the physician to all overall really help guide therapy with something like MDMA and other compounds.
And to summarize, you know, we all have our immunoassays available for drugs of abuse testing, which do provide that broad cross-reactivity. And then you mentioned mass spec, which does provide a better signature for targeted testing. And you mentioned that labs are doing a good job of introducing mass spec. Is there a trend of more mass spec coming in-house for hospital laboratories? Or is it still kind of like that market that you mentioned?
Yeah. You know, I saw a statistic that said globally, less than 1% of laboratory results is generated by mass spectrometry. So I think for most of us that do mass spec, we think it's dominating and we think it's everywhere and yeah. we think everybody wants to do it. But I think ultimately what we find is it's still not something that is widespread and very mainstream.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it isn't because it's not seen as very valuable. But certainly, as we've seen the trends with, you know, lack of staffing and lack of sort of, you know, educational opportunities and training opportunities, it makes it very difficult to bring in new technologies into areas where you don't already have that sort of established footprint. And so for the most part, mass spectrometry has kind of largely stayed at reference laboratories that have R&D departments or can kind of put those resources to this. Mm-hmm. Large academic medical centers have gotten into the game. And what's really kind of interesting is years ago, vitamin D sort of ushered in a new era of clinical mass spectrometry because there was so much revenue being generated that it allowed everybody to sort of, you know, get into that type of testing, which I think was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But vitamin D is interesting because then we've actually seen a lot of this say, you know, I bought this instrument to do vitamin D testing. We developed this method. Physicians were excited. But then ultimately we realized, boy, there's a big technical burden here. And there's a need for technologists to have continuous training. And, you know, as we see, you know, the retirement happen quicker than people entering into the field, it starts getting harder and harder to maintain some of these more manual type approaches. And so I think mass spec had a boom with vitamin D. And then once everybody could do vitamin D, it was obvious to say, well, what else could we potentially be doing by mass spectrometry that would be better? Therapeutic drug monitoring became sort of, you know, very popular because, again, metabolites were very important. Cross-reactivity was a challenge. Urine toxicology with pain management gave another sort of big boost to this as well. But we've really started to see, I think, a bit of a stall with clinical mass spectrometry when it could really start having significant advantages for, you know, things like protein analyses, which are very complicated from a sample prep perspective. And certainly complicated from a mass spec perspective as well. So, you know, the technology hasn't gone far enough to make it simple to use like a clinical analyzer, but there are new technologies coming onto the market and there are new ways in which this is going to be approached. And so I'm still very, you know, hopeful that at one point a clinical analyzer will be right next to a mass spectrometer and the average technologist or technician will not know the difference between them and it'll be the same experience. But we'll be generating fundamentally better results off of the mass spectrometer that has been automated. But I think we're definitely still further away from that. But in the meantime, we do have this very large cohort of the laboratory that is positioned well to be able to support things like psychedelics, where we need specific results, we need timely results, and an immunoassay may not be able to do this. And so it will be interesting to see as more of these type of alternative therapies become available, whether or not this is yet another push for laboratories to get into mass spectrometry with hopefully having vendor supported solutions that make it simpler and easier for us to get to these. Because some of the other compounds that we'll actually talk about, you know, there are very limited immunoassays available. So mm-hmm. now all of a sudden it becomes even more challenging for the typical laboratory to support, because if you don't have mass spectrometry, but there aren't immunoassays available, well, now there's really no way to support this kind of testing. So that represents, again, another bit of a barrier for, you know, all of these compounds to really go mainstream.
I think you've just foreshadowed some of the other drugs we'll be talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
This episode of Off the Bench is sponsored by the University of Cincinnati Online. Did you know qualified leaders in medical laboratory science are in high demand? The University of Cincinnati Online's Master's in Medical Laboratory Science Leadership provides the skills that dedicated professionals need to fill those roles. The fully online program lets you balance life and work while completing your degree, and the world-class faculty will support you every step of the way. Take the next step in advancing your medical laboratory career. Visit online.uc.edu/MSMLS.
So let's get into it. Let's talk about ketamine a little bit, moving away from our psychedelic world and moving more into a disassociative world. Tell me a little bit about ketamine, how it's used, mechanism of action, et cetera.
Yeah. So, you know, ketamine is interesting because oftentimes ketamine, you know, we're kind of going through these, I think, in order of the way in which people are probably somewhat familiar with them. So everybody's probably heard of MDMA, certainly if you're a clinical toxicologist. Ketamine, certainly everybody's heard of, but you probably think of it more associated with certainly abuse. maybe with veterinary use. And so oftentimes, whenever I'm sort of sitting in a group of toxicologists and somebody talks about a ketamine positive, you know, there's always almost always the joke made about, well, I guess somebody broke into a veterinary office, and because it's still very widely used there, but hasn't historically been as used as widely in human use. But it is a non-barbiturate dissociative. It's FDA approved for the use in anesthesia. So it does help to produce this procedural sedation. But it has been used off-label in a number of studies for pain management, which I think is really quite interesting and starts to show a little bit of that, you know, utility of these compounds that have largely been seen, you know, for other uses for sure. This is another one that I think is also really quite interesting as well, as there are stereoisomers that exist that have, you know, completely different sort of physiological profiles. And so sometimes they can be used as a racemic mixture, and otherwise they're sort of, you know, separated. And it really has to do with whether or not they're being utilized for one approach versus another. And so it really starts to kind of unravel the same kind of idea we talked about with MDMA, and we sort of talked about with even amphetamine as an example, is just getting a ketamine result may not be enough. When we know that ketamine is out there and could potentially be abused, but we also know that ketamine is used for anesthesia. We know that ketamine may be actually used for pain management. And then we know ketamine now can be used potentially for some of the other treatments associated with psychedelics. It may start to become very important to not just provide a ketamine result, but a specific ketamine result. So, you know, a racemic profile, you know, of RNS and the relative amounts of those. And so I think what's really kind of the foreshadowing for me on the clinical lab side is some of these newer compounds that are coming onto the market, you know, may have more expectations around what the laboratory needs to provide, as opposed to what we're used to with drugs of abuse, which is if there, it's not there. And if it's there, well, it's not supposed to be there. So that's your answer. But here it may be the situation where just being there is not what we're looking for, but we're looking for the profile and what else is it actually with there, and what other sort of isoforms are there.
What is the current gold standard for testing in a clinical laboratory for ketamine in terms of methodology?
So it's actually kind of interesting. So ketamine is one of these where it really starts to sort of unravel in regards to sort of what is available. And so right now, you know, at least at the time that we were sort of preparing, you know, our presentation last year, the only immunoassays that were really on the market were listed as used for law enforcement or criminal justice or forensic use only. So what that ultimately tells you is, again, there's this sort of idea that ketamine is really only going to be found in forensic testing where people are abusing it, potentially dying from it, or using it in a way they're not supposed to. On the clinical side, you know, unfortunately, there just has not been a big enough demand for there to be immunoassays that are available. We have seen vendors, you know, presenting at various conferences that they do have immunoassays that are sort of coming out that can help to support this. So that kind of shows that, you know, the trends are moving in the direction of having this availability. But one of the limitations when we have to rely on vendors is there has to be a critical number of users for a vendor to develop something. It'd be great if vendors would develop, you know, kits for one customer, but they'd never be able to afford to do that. And so for that reason, they almost always have to be a little bit behind the times to be able to make sure that they're not too early and that there's not going to be a lot of issue of interest with that.
And it sounds like because it's currently not really in a clinical setting and more of a forensic setting, is there even an interpretive guidance for therapeutic monitoring? Probably not.
Yeah, so that becomes very interesting too. And it's another area where sort of our call to action out of our symposia last year was to say, you know, not only do you have to sort of think about how do you name these tests, but also what is your interpretive guidance? And, you know, most of the time, if you look at, you know, once we kind of move into things like ketamine, certainly there's a complete lack of immunoassays that are available. There's some ELISAs that are on the market that are, again, not FDA cleared or approved. But then when you start looking at mass spectrometry, which again is a very powerful tool, we can ultimately sort of do whatever we want to in a lot of ways with that as a lab developed test. It's mostly on the forensic side. And so to your point, if you were to find a laboratory that currently does ketamine, but you are a clinical lab and they're a forensic lab, when you get your results back, they're going to show you, well, this is what it looks like when you abuse ketamine, and this is the interpretation. And you're going to say, well, that's not very helpful because I don't have a patient that's abusing ketamine. Yeah. I have a patient that's actually being provided ketamine. And that is one of the responsibilities of the laboratory on the clinical side, is to provide interpretive guidance to physicians to make sure that it's the result is not just a number without any context, but we need to have reference intervals if possible, therapeutic ranges, and then some kind of interpretive guidance. So a physician can say, okay, this makes sense or this doesn't make sense. I need to follow up with the lab, or I can actually take it from here and I can sort of help guide the therapy of my patient.
It'll be fascinating to see over the next few years how the emergence of therapeutic use of these compounds is going to increase the pressure and the need to build out clinical use tests.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can already start to see that a little bit with some of the vendors, but also even some of the reference laboratories. You can start seeing, you know, things like hallucinogen panels that are starting to emerge, right? Which is much better than saying a drugs of abuse panel. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're starting to sort of classify these, trying to use sort of the right keywords for this. But to your point, there's still a lot lacking in regards to, you know, now we might have a nice panel and a nice sort of group of compounds for somebody to test. But what kind of interpretive guidance are we providing? That still sort of remains to be seen. And I think a lot of that is because we're not still sure entirely. You know, from a clinical trial perspective, it's very clear how there's going to be a need to sort of support the therapies as they develop and sort of to really understand what they need to be able to do. But once these therapies are maybe used more mainstream and once we're past the clinical trial perspective, I don't think it's clear right yet whether or not we're going to be doing this as therapeutic drug monitoring, if we're going to be doing this routinely, or if it's going to be more of like I mentioned earlier, a baseline assessment. Do you have ketamine already in your system? Have you been trying to do this yourself? If not, you're approved for the therapy, we'll take you through the therapy, but there's almost always going to be a need for a physician to be confident that their patient is not taking other drugs, that they're not abusing. And if they gave them ketamine today and it's 3 weeks later and they're here for their next session, maybe they want to do another ketamine screen to make sure that they're not taking it when they're not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be really difficult. And I think a lot of that will probably not be based on the therapy and the clinical need necessarily, but more the abuse concerns, because that is sort of the stigma around these. And it will still exist. You know, the compounds are still going to be able to be purchased or found in other avenues. And for that reason, there may be that sort of hardwiring in the physician's mind now of, well, I used to prescribe opiates and opiates started getting abused. Well, now I need to be very careful about prescribing these and prescribing this therapy because they could also be abused. It's going to be interesting to see how that develops. And it really has a lot less to do with the therapy and the efficacy of the therapy and more about what is a person and a patient going to do when they're actually being provided this therapy. And I don't know if anybody could really predict that very well.
And it highlights the importance of the really the signatures, like you were saying, that what's coming off the street versus what's provided as a part of therapy was going to have quite different signatures, and the need to delicately differentiate between the two to say, yep, my patient is taking it appropriately, or are they now addicted to this and are finding it elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that really shows sort of the interdependency and the need for forensic labs that are doing seized drug testing, that are getting these really early signatures of what's being mixed together. And then clinical laboratories saying we are starting to see this in our patients, and then certainly getting that end spectrum of the postmortem results too. That entire network is extremely valuable, but there are very few laboratories that have that entire continuum under their sort of individual laboratory certification. And so it really requires an enormous amount of coordination between forensic labs and clinical labs. And even though I'm sure anybody in those areas will say that would be fantastic, we'd love to mm-hmm. coordinate, we'd love to collaborate. Yeah. It all comes down to how many hours in the day are there? Is this an absolute necessary for us to actually do? And I think that really becomes the challenge of the, you know, the workforce challenges that every clinical lab is still facing, really hampers a lot of the progress that the lab should make and would want to make, but you really just got to be able to do the testing you already have. And so it's very difficult to start thinking about branching out into some of these other areas of testing and also some of these collaborative efforts when you barely have enough people to get through the day.
That gave me chills. I mean, how did we move out of the silo that is clinical laboratory? And the vision is great. It's just, how do we achieve it?
Right.
Let's get into the psychedelics that we've mentioned, starting with psilocybin and or magic mushrooms, as some people know it.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is one that I think probably has the most sort of clinical trial and sort of history behind it in regards to sort of its use as a therapeutic for sure. But it also has a very interesting sort of history and associated with exactly, if you talk to people about psilocybin, they'll probably think about magic mushrooms and all of that. This is the one that I think sort of really sort of makes the news, and a lot of people, there's documentaries about it. And so, you know, this is something we talked about in our Q&A article, with some of the experts on how do you think the media is going to influence the path of these different compounds. And so, you know, that's really hard to kind of understand and know, but I think at this point you cannot escape the fact that anything that's going into sort of the public domain is going to be on social media. People are going to have opinions and those are going to spread. So I think psilocybin is really interesting though, because most of the time what people don't know about psilocybin is almost all of the effects that we talk about with psilocybin is actually attributed to psilocin, which is actually sort of the primary metabolite. So psilocybin really can kind of be considered a prodrug more than anything. And so it's rapidly metabolized to psilocin. And so that's really where you actually see a lot of these therapeutic effects, as well as these sort of, you know, various different impacts that are associated with psilocybin overall. I think the real challenge with psilocybin, which is, I think, interesting, is it's rapidly metabolized, it's unstable under the influence of light and air. And so for that reason, when you think about a clinical lab that wants to test these, knowing that your analyte is unstable in light and air makes it extremely challenging to think about getting very good test results from this, because there's a lot of pre-analytical issues that go into the testing for this. And so, you know, typically when we think about sort of laboratory testing, pre-analytical issues are still a huge component to the error associated with laboratory testing, and is oftentimes something that's very difficult to control.
This may be a silly question. When we are thinking, since you're saying it's a prodrug, if we test this in urine or any body fluid, are we actually then testing for psilocin or are we testing for psilocybin?
Yeah, so that gets really challenging. So for the most part, you would really never test for psilocybin because it's going to be fairly rapidly metabolized. And then this becomes sort of really a central tenet to toxicology and clinical toxicology testing is what matrix are you actually using? And that's really going to dictate what compound you're going to be looking for, and, you know, what concentrations you would actually expect as well. And so, you know, for the most part, you know, we're definitely going to be looking for, you know, psilocin in urine. And most likely we'll probably be looking for psilocin in serum plasma as well, if that's ultimately what we'd be looking at. But it's going to be, it becomes one of these really interesting nomenclature questions where if you have a physician who's providing psilocybin as the drug, you know, maybe not knowing necessarily that it gets rapidly metabolized to psilocin and that's really what the impacts are for. Well, if I want to be a chemical purist and I want to have my test be named exactly what it's supposed to be, well, then I might put a psilocin test online. And then a physician would go to my test menu and they would say, well, I guess they don't test for psilocybin. And then they would go to the next laboratory. And so I think we have to be very careful as laboratorians to make sure that we're not being so overly technical and so overly specific in what we're doing and make sure that our target audience and our target customer, if you want to call it that, is a physician. And so we really need to make sure that our tests are easy to find, easy to understand, easy to interpret. And sometimes that may mean calling it something that's not entirely correct, even though that's definitely what it's going to be recognized by when the individual goes to order that test.
You mentioned that with psilocybin and psilocin, it is the challenge is the pre-analytical issues. And I wanted to get into that a little bit more. You were saying that it is rapidly metabolized and it's unstable in light and air. Has there been an exploration of how do we stabilize it? Is there an additive? Is there what work is being done to address the pre-analytical issues?
Yeah, and so that's where I think there is a lot that we can borrow and we can learn from, you know, current testing that's already been done in the forensic field and some of the other areas as well. And so it's pretty well known that, you know, blood samples stored at room temperature, there's going to be a pretty rapid and pretty continuous decrease, even 90% loss within a week. And so it's not hard to appreciate that most laboratorians will tell you that it's typically not good practice to let a sample sit out on the bench for a week. You know, we wouldn't normally do that anyway. And so we don't typically have to worry about that. But it really does become a question of, well, you know, what if a phlebotomist collects that sample and they, you know, send it to the laboratory, the laboratory is backed up and it sits on the counter for 30 minutes, for 60 minutes, for 90 minutes. You know, those are the kinds of questions that I think we still need to some degree understand. And so then ultimately, you know, we have these kinds of scenarios that play out in the laboratory all of the time, which is if you draw a sample specific for a test, well, then you have criteria, right? And so one of the best things that we can actually do is you can refrigerate the sample, right? So, you know, that in itself starts to cause some challenges still though, right? Because we've had such situations for other tests in the lab where you say that the sample has to be put onto ice, But that has to be, if you're doing serum, for instance, well, it has to be after it clots, right? You can't put an unclotted test sample onto ice because it's going to clot slower. And so this normal 5 minutes at room temperature to help clot is going to take longer. And so you're going to have micro clots. You're going to have lots of challenges with the sample itself. And so all of those pre-analytical issues become, you know, even greater challenges to getting this actually done. And then there's other things that we can actually borrow from the forensic world, which, you know, oftentimes for forensic testing, they don't have a choice of the type of samples they get, right? And you can't go back and say, we need you to redraw the sample because it's hemolyzed or it's not a perfect sample. You get what you get sometimes on the forensic side. And so there's a lot of information that we can actually learn from there. And so fluoride addition, you know, typically we think about in the clinical lab, you rarely ever use a fluoride containing tube, but on the forensic side, it's very widely commonly used because it's a good inhibitor of a lot of the enzymes that will typically degrade and sort of metabolize some of these compounds. And so getting the right tube type, that in itself, if you start thinking about a physician wanting to order a test for psilocybin, well, now all of a sudden they have to make sure that the test gets drawn in a fluoride containing tube. Well, that in itself is already a little bit of a complex kind of scenario. Has to be put onto ice. You know, all of these sort of things make it that much harder for individuals to be able to get a good result from that. But we do have a lot of ways in which we can actually do that. And so for that reason, you know, proper storage, you know, proper tube type, all of the normal things we typically think about getting a good laboratory result are still there. And then the real question is, well, what if you ultimately have issues with light and air stability? That's a pretty hard one. There's not a lot you can do to keep samples from being exposed to light and air other than to have foil wrap tubes, you know, and then, you know, whenever the cap's taken off, you can't let it sit with the cap off for very long. You can kind of see how I don't want to be the technician or technologist that has to run that sample because it now gets really complicated. And so, you know, making it as simple as possible is definitely something that will have to continue to be developed on the psilocybin side for sure.
I could also see them adding testing limitation like we do with blood gases, test within a certain amount of minutes as well. Are there, do you know from the forensic world, is there any indication of how hemolysis would affect psilocybin in other pre-analytical errors that might take place?
Yeah. And so for the most part, you know, it's pretty widely known that anytime you have, you know, hemolysate that's present or you have sort of red cells that rupture, they let out a whole lot of stuff that's typically supposed to be obviously inside the red cells. And so those are going to be enzymes that, that kind of spill into the sample. And so those really start digesting and sort of metabolizing the compounds for sure. So for that reason, it's another why having fluoride in there can help to offset that. Freezing the sample can help offset that. So anything you can do to try to slow down that natural metabolism that's going to occur, that's definitely something that's widely utilized on the forensic side. But it's also interesting too, because on the forensic side, oftentimes concentration is not necessarily, you know, an absolute, right? Because there's so many things that can actually occur. And so it really becomes a question of, you know, will we ever have a test for psilocybin and psilocin that actually is quantitatively valuable and really has sort of clear targets? Or will we only be able to give a qualitative result? You know, I think that becomes sort of a challenge in regards to what's going to be needed for interpretation.
That's a fantastic point, because now thinking about it, if you're testing psilocin, which the body breaks down, isn't the concentration also dependent person by person and how quickly they break down a compound?
Yeah, and so that definitely becomes, I mean, that's sort of a universal challenge really with clinical toxicology is the, you know, the pharmacokinetics of this, right? And so, you know, you deal with sort of the fact that, well, how does the drug actually act on the body and the pharmacodynamics of it? But then there's also, well, you know, every single thing your body ingests, it typically is trying to metabolize and certainly on the drug side, trying to get rid of through multiple different mechanisms. And so for that reason, you know, understanding that pharmacokinetic profile, you know, is something that, you know, remains to continue to be studied and unraveled and understood sort of even at a deeper level. But yeah, one of the real challenges with that is when you think about sort of even half-lives, you know, typically there are half-lives that are associated with drugs. But if you look in the literature, they are sometimes wide in regards to the range, right? So you could have, you know, 50 minutes up to 75 minutes, you know, 160 minutes, 250 minutes. And some of that is dose dependent. Some of that is dependent upon the pharmacogenetics of the individual and how it's metabolized. And some of that is just the variability in the testing that was done in order to support that pharmacokinetic study. So it really becomes difficult. That's also why, you know, individuals that interpret clinical toxicology testing and forensic toxicology testing spend a lot of time learning, being certified, and honing their craft to make sure that they can understand and also provide explanations with all of those limitations taken into account. But that really is the challenge of how do you take all of those years of experience and training and translate it into easy to understand interpretive guidance that a physician who doesn't have all that experience and understanding can still utilize that result. And that's not just a clinical toxicology problem. That's a universal problem of how do we communicate the most value out of the testing that we provide.
Right. What I'm hearing as a summary is that, you know, there is no clinical testing available for psilocybin yet. This is really forensic or research use only that's available. Is this where mass spec comes to the rescue again or no?
Yep, absolutely. And so I think anytime where, you know, we're trying to do something with an immunoassay and it's not widely supported by a vendor, then mass spectrometry, exactly as you say, is one of those times where it can come to the rescue, can provide a test. And assuming, of course, that the analyte can be monitored by mass spec, and, you know, for the most part, we almost universally can find some type of mass spectrometry that would actually use. This is another situation where, you know, there are no immunoassays for psilocybin that I'm aware of on the market that are certainly for clinical use. And I don't even think there's really anything, at least at this point, for forensic use. And so that essentially does leave mass spectrometry as really the only avenue to get that kind of testing done. So there are some, you know, psilocin tests for CLIA laboratories that are actually out there. But at the same time, you know, it's going to be very difficult to find and very difficult to come across. And if we're looking for relatively rapid and sort of near-term results for the patient, then if there's only one CLIA lab in the country that does it, well, that's not going to be a very easy way to get fast turnaround time results for sure.
Right, right. Last, let's finish off our chapter with talking about DMT, which I would say not everyone has heard of what even DMT is. And to be honest, up until speaking with you, I didn't realize that DMT was used in any therapeutic manner at all. So can you tell us a little bit more about what DMT is, what it does, how it's used?
Yeah, absolutely. So DMT is interesting. So if you've heard of psilocin, you've almost heard of DMT because psilocin's chemical name is 4-hydroxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine, and DMT is N,N-dimethyltryptamine. And so you can already kind of see how they're very similar in structure. And so for that reason, have very similar sort of activities and sort of fit into that same kind of classification as a hallucinogen. What's really interesting about DMT is it's referred to as an endogenous hallucinogen because it's actually formed from tryptophan. And so this kind of starts to form a little bit of the basis of why providing added amounts of DMT may actually be valuable because it's already there as a baseline. We're making it endogenously. The question is sort of what is it actually doing endogenously and can we actually mimic that if we actually provide it, you know, exogenously as well. But DMT is really interesting because we're never going to be able to measure DMT because it does have an extremely fast half-life. And so typically, you know, DMT is interesting because it can be administered IV for various different reasons. The blood levels actually peak really quickly after IV administration, but essentially 30 minutes after that, it's almost essentially gone. So it's one of these very rapid half-life kind of drugs. And so for that reason, it essentially has to be sort of administered and maintained at a certain concentration in order to have those hallucinogenic effects. And then this is another one of those where we're certainly not going to be measuring DMT for those reasons. So the N-dol-3-acetic acid sort of metabolite is really what we'd go after in this standpoint. And so, you know, at this point then, you know, if somebody has oral ingestion or even IV use of DMT, you're typically not going to see that in the urine. So instead, you're going to be going after that N-dol-3-acetic acid metabolite, potentially even conjugates of that. And so this is really where I think, you know, there's more to potentially be studied as to, you know, what exactly are we going to be looking for and what would the laboratory be asked to monitor? And across all of these, will the laboratory be asked to monitor? I think that still kind of remains to be seen as to what type of support will the clinical laboratory really provide ultimately for these therapies?
As soon as you mentioned that it's an endogenous hallucinogen, I just thought of all the many articles or forums that talk about how at the end of life, we all release as a final burst DMT as just one final push. And I haven't referenced my high school forums in a long time, but that is responsible for like the white light tunnel description. It's the last feel good producing substance that your body gives out. And what I'm curious about is it actually being used as therapeutic for mental health now?
Yeah, so it's another one of those. It's definitely sort of on the short list of compounds that's being actively explored. I think it has its own limitations and its own challenges for sure. And I think it's a matter of, you know, which of the compounds are out there, you know, have the greatest amount of sort of capability to be able to have that kind of therapeutic potential. But it's definitely one that's always kind of talked about in the mix with all the other compounds. And so for that reason, you know, it's definitely on the list. It's a lot of ones that people are looking at. And I think one of the big values that DMT brings is that really short half-life. And so you do have the capability to utilize something that has a very quick on rate and a very quick off rate to be able to do some perhaps some targeted therapies or, you know, potential, you know, different administrations that you might see otherwise.
Is there currently any testing available for DMT even outside of clinical?
Yeah, so for DMT, I mean, it gets even more complicated. And so, you know, when we were sort of looking through the literature to see what we could actually find, you know, no publications on immunoassays were available, nothing out there sort of for forensic use or even research use only. And sometimes we talked about this a little bit earlier, sometimes you can get this sort of like useful cross-reactivity with other immunoassays. But as of right now, no vendors on the market that make things for amphetamine or MDMA or other types of stimulants demonstrated any kind of cross-reactivity. Doesn't mean that it doesn't cross-react. It just means that they didn't test it. They didn't challenge the assay with that. And then when it comes to mass spectrometry, there are methods that are actually available and are published. But as of right now, they're pretty much sort of one compound in a very large postmortem screen. So certainly not the kind of test that you would think, you know, I have a patient that being given DTM or I'm concerned about them abusing DMT. Why don't I order this postmortem screen? Like that's not going to be a natural connection that a physician's going to make for sure.
And even the cross reactivity seems to be severely limited because like you mentioned, the half-life is really short. And so you need to be testing a patient that's just taken this drug.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the challenges too with all small molecules is just getting an immunoassay to actually work, which is another reason why mass spectrometry is so valuable and so useful, is the smaller the compound gets, the harder it is to get an immune response to actually occur. And so ultimately, that's where the design of the immunoassays are sometimes overly sort of tuned to, you know, whatever the sort of complex is that was formed with the drug to try to elicit immune response, as opposed to the drug itself. And that's where a lot of those cross-reactivities come into play. But it's also where sometimes there's just a limitation on being able to develop the technology. Even if there was a large market need for it, there may be some limitations just in how, you know, immunoassays really develop. And again, that's where I think mass spectrometry really has the greatest potential for success, is being able to circumvent the need for antibodies, being able to circumvent the need for that typical type of testing. The challenge again is if mass spectrometry is not widely available, not known to be easy to use, well, then that becomes sort of a sticking point still in being able to actually have the testing available.
Fred, if there's anything that I learned from this presentation, I learned a lot, but I have a much bigger appreciation for mass spec more than my organic chemistry labs ever did. And I used that. I used mass spec a lot and now I appreciate it. So thank you for that.
That's great to hear.
And you know, you mentioned that there's quite a big challenge of bringing mass spec in-house to provide timely results. And I'm wondering, coming back to what you do with Mobile Ion, is that a technology that could potentially solve the mass spec shortage of staff and training?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's one of the reasons that drew me to Mobile Ion as a company. So their technology is called Structures for Lossless Ion Manipulation, or SLIM. And so right now they're commercial product is called Mobi, and that's what's really sort of on the market and sort of solving problems now in various different areas. But what's really unique about it is it has this immense resolving power. And so if you think about sort of the ability to separate things, normally the longer you let the separation occur, the better it's going to do. For ion mobility, it's all about how long can you let the ions move through a path to be able to get that separation. And there's a lot of limitations to other technologies that are on the market. Ours has 13 meters or 42 feet of ion mobility path length. But what's really unique about ours is we can turn ions around corners. And so then when you think about what it must look like to have 42 feet of path length, it's actually in about an 18 by 14 inch sort of form factor. And so it's a serpentine pattern that really makes it quite small, but unbelievably powerful. And so then what we get from that is we have the ability to position it to reduce reliance on LC. And so we have a lot of really great applications and a lot of focus on being able to keep LC in place, but at the same time, not have to rely on it for identification, or, you know, it doesn't have to be as perfect as it typically has been for LC mass spec. And so what that means is we can use the ion mobility dimension, which is really reproducible, doesn't have a lot of those same kind of challenges, and we can decouple this complexity of LC, which is really where the challenge ultimately comes from with mass spectrometry. And we can have ion mobility, mass spectrometry as the way in which we identify compounds, we turn out our results, and then we can use LC to help the sample not have ion suppression and some of those other challenges that are typically, you know, solved by LC. And so really what that comes down to is a perfect example of where, you know, one of the applications that we were working on, we were doing a replicate analysis. And as oftentimes happens, the LC just had a misstep. And so the chromatography doesn't look quite as good as it should. Normally in a clinical lab, you would look at that and you would say, well, that's not a good result. I've got to reprep the sample. There's going to be delay in testing. But if you look in the ion mobility dimension, it lined up perfectly with everything else. And so what that tells you is the ion mobility dimension can help foolproof the LC dimension. So for that reason, the burden, the technological burden for the average sort of user is going to be much lower to use a system like ours than it would be with sort of what's on the market now. So we definitely feel very strongly that we'll have a very positive impact in clinical testing. And we're certainly doing this now in multiple different areas. But certainly making mass spectrometry easy to use is one of the major points that we are focused on in regards to how do we decentralize mass spectrometry and really make it a technology that everybody can use.
That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you to everyone listening, tuning in to another episode of our Off the Bench podcast. We hope you had a wonderful lab week and really took the time to celebrate the hard work that we do, whether through lab activities and or reflection on all that you have accomplished and celebrating the future you. And Dr. Strathman, thank you so much for joining us today with your insight on the topic.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks to everybody listening. And thank you so much for what you do every day for patient care.
And if there is anyone out here that wants to reach out to Dr. Strathman, we will include his email in the description on the ASCLS website. Until next time, Labvocates.
This episode of Off the Bench is sponsored by the University of Cincinnati Online. Take the next step in your medical laboratory career today with the University of Cincinnati Online. Earn a Master of Science in Medical Laboratory Science Leadership fully online and learn what you need to advance. Visit online.uc.edu/MSMLS for more details.